6. Labyrinth. In the United States, the Controlled Substances Act of 1970 exists to protect the public from potentially harmful drugs. This law also is a barrier preventing access to those drugs by the clinical research community. It is the labyrinth through which anyone who wishes to perform human research with psychedelic drugs must pass. The Controlled Substances Act placed all drugs into schedules, depending on their abuse potential, currently accepted medical use, and safety of use under medical supervision. Schedule 1 drugs, the most restricted, are highly abusable, lack medical utility, and are unsafe under medical supervision. Over the objections of dozens of high-level psychiatric researchers, including Dr. Daniel Friedman, Congress placed LSD and all the other psychedelic drugs into Schedule 1. Schedule 2 includes drugs like methamphetamine and cocaine. They possess high abuse potential, but some medical utility. Cocaine is a local anesthetic for eye surgery, and methamphetamine for the treatment of hyperactive children, for example. Codeine is in Schedule 3, because this commonly used painkiller has abuse potential less than Schedule 1 and 2 drugs, as well as fewer and less severe adverse consequences when used under medical supervision. Schedule 4 drugs like Xanax and Valium possess abuse potential less than Schedule 3 and have limited problems associated with their medical use. In the case of the psychedelics, the high abuse potential that lawmakers noted was not the compulsive, out-of-control use commonly seen with drugs like heroin and cocaine. Psychedelics don't cause craving or withdrawal. In fact, one of their hallmarks is that they produce almost no effects after 3 or 4 daily doses, and abruptly stopping them causes no withdrawal. Rather, it was their acute effects that were so profoundly disruptive and at times disabling. Because of those highly destabilizing effects, Congress decided psychedelics must be tightly regulated. Clinical research scientists in the 1950s and 1960s recognized and usually took into account the unique dangers of LSD and other psychedelics. By doing so, they could successfully prevent or quickly deal with any adverse psychological reactions to these drugs. However, uncontrolled public use and media-intensive breaches in research protocols by Leary and his colleagues at Harvard brought the expected responses. These drugs were causing highly publicized problems, and the door had to be shut for damage control. In order to turn this tide of abuse, Congress emphasized psychedelics' negative properties at the expense of their positive or neutral ones. What one day was safety under medical supervision became lack of safety under medical supervision the next. Medical utility as research and training tools and aids to psychotherapy quickly changed into no currently acceptable medical use. It was into this black hole I peered as I prepared to shepherd the DMT protocol through the regulatory system. The process began in December 1988. I kept a log during the next 2 years of every phone call, letter, meeting, fax, and discussion related to 89001, the DMT protocol. From my notes, I summarized and extracted the most relevant information obtained from these interactions and wrote them up in 1990, immediately after getting permission to begin the study. I referred to this article as the "What If I'm Run Over by a Bus" paper. It was important that other people knew how to wind their way through this maze. It was possible, and there was a route through it. If nothing else came of the DMT project, I wanted to leave behind this map for success. The initial guardians of the regulatory realms were two University of New Mexico School of Medicine committees, the Research Center's Scientific Advisory Committee, and the Human Research Ethics Committee. The General Clinical Research Center Scientific Advisory Committee dealt with the science behind my proposal. Fellow researchers on the panel looked at the scientific merit of the study and offered remedial suggestions. They also decided whether to allow its performance at the research center and whether to pay for the many blood tests I requested. Because I had spent the last 2 years running the Human Melatonin Project at the research center, I was a member of this committee at the time. The Human Research Ethics Committee dealt with the safety of my proposed study. Its duties were to make sure the project had an acceptable safety profile, and that the informed consent document clearly spelled out the nature of the study and its risks. It was incredibly fortunate that the chairman of the crucial ethics committee was a firm believer in libertarianism, that is, that the individual takes precedence over the state. He believed that educated people could make up their own minds. His motto, as head of one of the first and most important review panels, was great encouragement. We're not here to play God. The informed consent document is a crucial element of human research. In it, the researcher describes the objectives of the protocol and why he or she is performing it. The consent states exactly, and in mind-numbing detail, what to expect from participating. It lists the potential risks and benefits associated with volunteering, details how the research team will manage risks, and notes that volunteers will receive all necessary treatment for adverse effects free of charge. The consent reminds the potential research subject that participation is totally voluntary and ongoing. He or she may withdraw at any time, for any reason, with no penalty or withholding of necessary care. In case a volunteer feels unfairly treated, the informed consent document provides names and phone numbers of people he or she can contact in order to complain. While negotiating with the university committees, I also began working with the two United States federal agencies that formed the final and more formidable regulatory barriers. They held in their hands the ultimate decisions. The first was the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, DEA. They had a local Albuquerque office, but their headquarters were in Washington, D.C. The DEA would decide if I would be allowed to possess DMT. If granted, this permission would take the form of a Schedule I permit. The other federal regulatory agency was the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, FDA, which also is based in Washington, D.C. The FDA would decide if it was safe and worthwhile to give DMT to human research volunteers in my study. If granted, the FDA's permission would take the form of an investigational new drug, IND, permit. When submitting the protocol to the university committees, I told them the study would not begin until the FDA and DEA both gave their permission to administer DMT. However, these federal agencies first required local approval. The informed consent document would be a major hurdle, and I was direct with the ethics committee about the expected effects of DMT. I did not want to lull volunteers into thinking it would be an easy day, but I also did not want to scare them away by emphasizing potential negative effects. On page 2 of the consent, this is what the volunteer read. I understand that the primary effects of this drug are psychological. Visual and/or auditory hallucinations or other perceptual distortions may occur. My sense of time may be altered, short lengths of time passing slowly, or vice versa. I may experience very powerful emotions, pleasurable or unpleasant. Opposite feelings or thoughts may be experienced at the same time. I may be extremely sensitive and aware of the environment. On the other hand, I may not notice anything at all in the environment. It may feel like my body and mind have separated. Feelings of impending or actual death or confusion may occur. Euphoria is very common. The onset of the experience is rapid, the experience being very intense, with the higher doses within 30 seconds. It peaks within 2 to 5 minutes and is usually felt as only a mild intoxication within 20 to 30 minutes. I will quite likely feel like my normal self within an hour after the injection. Regarding risks, the consent form was brief but honest. The main effects of DMT are psychological and have been described above. These usually last less than 1 hour. Rarely, emotional reactions to these effects may last longer, i.e., 24 to 48 hours. I can stay at the research center as long as necessary to regain my equilibrium, including overnight if desired. DMT is physically safe, mild to moderate brief increases in blood pressure and heart rate occur. It would have been premature and inappropriate to suggest in the informed consent that participation in the DMT study offered any potential benefits. While I knew volunteers probably would enjoy their DMT experiences, this was different from suggesting that I was providing treatment for a diagnosable condition. Thus, the consent went on to say, "There are no benefits to me personally as a result of participating in this research. However, the potential benefits are a greater understanding of the mechanism of action of hallucinogenic agents." Within a week of submitting the DMT study, the ethics committee asked me to include the phrase, "no currently accepted medical use," in the informed consent's introductory paragraph. I replied by suggesting this phrase would unnecessarily frighten off prospective volunteers. In addition, if I ever did get permission to run the study, the phrase would no longer, strictly speaking, be true. It then would have currently accepted medical use, in this case as a clinical research tool. They accepted this answer. Confidentiality and anonymity were important issues I had to work out with the Ethics Committee, the Research Center, and the University Hospital Administration. Nearly all the DMT volunteers had jobs and families, neither of which they cared to endanger by admitting to the use of illegal drugs. Confession to having broken the law was a prerequisite for enrolling in the study, since only experienced psychedelic drug users could participate. I met with staff from the hospital's medical records department and admitting offices, the head nurse and administrator of the research center, and the hospital's attorney. Together we worked out a complicated but effective arrangement. Records of the medical screening performed in the outpatient clinic of the research center would hold important medical information. This might be extraordinarily helpful if the volunteer at some future date developed health problems for which the treating physician needed baseline values, for example, regarding heart function. Therefore, we placed the volunteer's real name on the chart containing results of the physical examination and screening laboratory tests. In this chart was no mention of drug use, nor a linking of the volunteer to my drug studies. The signed informed consent document, which was usually attached to the chart, required the volunteer's real name on the signature line. To protect confidentiality, I kept all signed informed consents under lock and key in my home office. All that was necessary for the real name chart was the comment, "consent signed," held by principal investigator. Each volunteer then received a code number, such as DMT-3. From that point on, this anonymous identification was the only one they possessed, and I was the only person who knew the key. They each received a new hospital chart labeled only with their DMT number. The first time we used the code number was for the psychiatric examination detailing their history of drug use and emotional problems. There was one final concern. This related to outside agencies looking at charts in order to assess long-term effects of exposure to experimental drugs. In my melatonin studies, I included a phrase in the informed consent stating that the manufacturer of melatonin and the FDA might review patient files in order to investigate any risks or problems associated with receiving melatonin. When I included this comment in the DMT consent, prospective volunteers objected. Nevertheless, there had to be some mechanism by which legitimate investigation into possible long-term health risks resulting from DMT could occur. However, it must be voluntary. The compromise we developed was that if the FDA or the DMT manufacturer wanted to interview research volunteers or look at their medical records, they first had to go through me. I would check with the individual volunteers to see who was interested. Research records certainly could be subpoenaed, but without the key to the code numbers, they would be of limited use. I would refuse to divulge the key on the grounds of patient-doctor privilege. It would be a mess, but it was worth it. As it turns out, in 5 years of studies with over 60 DMT volunteers, not one breach of confidentiality or anonymity ever occurred. Neither have there been, 5 years since the study's completion, any requests by the authorities to review volunteers' charts. The Research Center's Scientific Advisory Committee acknowledged that the science of the DMT protocol was relatively direct and uncomplicated. They realized the primary obstacles were ethical, political, and administrative, areas in which they had less authority and responsibility than the Ethics Committee. There were security and liability concerns, however. The Research Center asked me to keep volunteers in the hospital overnight to make sure they were watched by the nursing staff for a full day after their participation. I replied that this would cut down on the number of prospective volunteers. Previous DMT studies had sent their volunteers home in the afternoon, following morning studies with good safety results. They accepted this. The Research Center scientists also wanted to establish the best time of day to give DMT. Was there a daily rhythm in DMT sensitivity? Were responses greater in the morning or evening? I answered that I didn't know, but that by giving DMT to everyone at the same time of day in the morning, we would standardize that factor. We could investigate possible changes in sensitivity throughout the day in a different study. My research colleagues also requested more justification from the animal literature for drawing blood levels of the various hormones I wanted to measure. These references were easy to provide. Finally, they wanted volunteers to submit urine samples for testing for drugs of abuse. Within a month, on February 19, 1989, the Research Center approved the DMT protocol. They also agreed to fund my request for testing hormone levels and for developing a method of measuring DMT in human blood. 3 days later, the Human Research Ethics Committee also approved the study. I then began looking for a source of DMT. At the same time, I had to make sure it was legal for me to possess it once I found it. The simpler of these two tasks was possession, and this depended on the DEA providing me a Schedule I permit. In April 1989, I met with the University Hospital Pharmacy about the security requirements the DEA would request for storing a Schedule I drug. Since the pharmacists previously had worked on a marijuana study, they believed their safeguards were adequate. I sent in my DEA Schedule I permit application. It stated that the permit was necessary to possess laboratory-grade DMT so we could begin developing a way to measure DMT in human blood. Later, the permit would need to cover the human-grade DMT volunteers would receive. This human-grade DMT needed to be purer than that required for laboratory work. Giving people DMT would not begin until the FDA approved the study and the purity of the human-grade drug. One section of the DEA application asked for DMT's drug number. I called the DEA office in Washington, D.C., and a staff person looked up DMT on the list of national drug codes. This number went into the appropriate box. I called the DEA 2 weeks later, but they had no record of receiving my application. The person with whom I spoke said, "We're moving into a new office and everything's in boxes." Another 2 weeks passed. Still no record of my request. In a few days, though, I received the entire application back. They needed the correct drug number for DMT. This number was on a sheet of paper they enclosed with the returned application. The person with whom I had spoken earlier had given me the wrong number. I entered the correct number and mailed back the revised application that day. The DEA also wanted a New Mexico Board of Pharmacy Schedule I permit. I applied for and received this certificate within a few weeks. "It's all up to the DEA," the staff at the New Mexico Board said. The DEA then told me they would approve the request for laboratory-grade DMT if the hospital pharmacy and staff passed necessary security checks. The paperwork went from Washington to Denver, and from Denver to Albuquerque. The local Albuquerque DEA field officer, Agent D, came to the university to meet me and look over the pharmacy in early June of 1989. She asked for the names of all those pharmacy staff who might have contact with the DMT, as well as our addresses, phone numbers, and social security numbers. She found several breaches in security and asked us to get a locked freezer. That freezer was to be placed in the locked narcotics vault. She said I could not have a copy of the freezer key, only the hospital pharmacists should. If any of the drug ended up missing, they didn't want to suspect me of stealing it. She had the unsettling habit of joking every so often. "Well, that won't land you in jail, and don't worry, we won't take you away in handcuffs for that." I tried to laugh with her. When we said goodbye that day, she summed it up. "It's your ass on the line. If anything goes wrong, theft, loss, bad record-keeping, we look to you for explanations." As anxious as her visit made me feel, Agent D's last words were the most troubling. "By the way, where will you get the DMT you'll give to your volunteers?" Later that month, the DEA approved in principle my request for permission to possess laboratory-grade DMT. I promised not to give this lower-grade drug to volunteers and would await FDA approval on human-grade DMT before starting the study. The DEA still held control over whether I could possess human-grade DMT, because this was to be a different batch of drug. In March 1989, within a week of obtaining university approvals for the DMT study, and just after mailing in my forms to the DEA, I called Sigma Laboratories in St. Louis, Missouri. Sigma was the chemical supply house that had provided melatonin for my human pineal project. There was a listing for DMT in their catalog, and I asked if they would sell some to me. I requested laboratory-grade DMT for our efforts to measure DMT in body fluids. I also asked for clinical-grade drug for human use. Sigma told me that there was no problem in purchasing laboratory-grade DMT. The only requirement was a Schedule I permit from the DEA. Obtaining human-grade DMT was going to be more complicated, as it called for Sigma putting together specific documentation for the FDA, a drug master file. Sigma recommended contacting the investigators who administered DMT to humans in previous studies to find out who had supplied them. Sigma then would know how much detail to provide the FDA. If there were problems finding out who used to have those files, they recommended utilizing the U.S. Freedom of Information Act. This law allows citizens to request privileged information as long as it does not threaten American national security interests. I obtained a list of all the currently active investigational drug permits in the country so that I could contact anyone who possessed one for DMT. Unfortunately, there weren't any. My request to find out about the existence of old permits using the Freedom of Information Act was not successful. There were no records or files at the FDA for previous DMT permits. My application to give DMT to humans went into the FDA in late April. I asked for a reactivation of the old DMT permits that the first generation of researchers had used, hoping the FDA itself might be able to find those old hidden files. One of the scientists who had given humans DMT, a co-author of the Decent Burial paper, agreed to let the FDA look at his old records on my behalf. However, in later correspondence, he discovered he had no information about the drug and couldn't remember who had been his supplier. He wished me good luck. In early May, the FDA sent their first letter, signed by Ms. P., advising that if they didn't get in touch within a month, the study could proceed. Of course, I had no DMT. However, they now had the application, and my request received a file number. Sigma now agreed to discuss with the FDA, putting together a drug master file for me. In June, Ms. P. at the FDA said Sigma was not providing them enough information about how their DMT was made. Sigma replied that their European DMT supplier refused to release any such information. It was a trade secret. Sigma also was concerned that the FDA was asking for more information about DMT than they did for other drugs Sigma previously had provided for human studies. Sigma gave me the name of the FDA chemist assigned to my application, Ms. R. She and I were to carry on dozens of conversations over the next year and a half. I asked Ms. R. why the FDA was requiring more information about DMT than they did about melatonin for my previous research. She replied, "It's case by case." Sigma complained that the FDA was being unreasonable. The FDA wouldn't move forward until they had more information. When I asked Ms. R. if she knew who was Sigma's supplier, saying that I wished to contact them directly myself, she offered their name. When I asked Sigma to confirm this, they were upset by what they felt was a breach of confidence. Nevertheless, they agreed to send the FDA all the information they possessed about their DMT. I asked Ms. R., if Sigma's DMT doesn't have all the necessary manufacturing data, could I purify it so it meets your requirements? She doubted it. The director of the division within the FDA where she worked before was the fellow who told me, at the brain science meeting some years back, "The dying have rights, too." He had blocked all requests by previous researchers to purify laboratory-grade drugs in order to give them to humans. "Maybe it's different now," she said. "This is a new division with new directors." This was true. The rising tide of AIDS and drug abuse brought into focus the delays in the drug approval process at the FDA. A new division formed to provide expedited review of new drugs for these problems. Fortunately, my DMT request went to this new division rather than Dr. L's, where my MDMA proposal never made any progress. Several months passed, and Ms. R. never did receive any information from Sigma. Sigma felt that the FDA had broken confidentiality, and they probably did not want to get any deeper into what they knew would be a long and complicated process. What was in it for them? I gave up hoping to obtain Sigma's DMT for human use. A densely worded letter arrived from the FDA in August 1989, spelling out 20 separate requirements the human-grade DMT must meet. There were no questions about general toxicity, which would require complicated and expensive animal testing. Nor were there concerns about the study's scientific merit. On those counts, in any event, I was encouraged. I called the chemist colleague who previously had offered his dire prediction about my only publication being one on the failure to obtain permission to run the study. I asked him directly, "Will you make me some DMT?" He declined. He did not believe his current laboratory would meet the requirements to qualify as a manufacturer. It would be too expensive and time-consuming to try. I also asked David Nichols, Ph.D., a chemist and pharmacologist at Purdue University in Indiana. He recommended Dr. K at the National Institute of Mental Health, who directed a program that made hard-to-find research drugs. Dr. K said his contract prohibited use of his compounds in humans, although perhaps in the future he might request to synthesize human-grade drugs. Dr. K recommended calling Lu G., an old colleague at a chemical supply house in Chicago. As it turned out, Lou, who stayed on after another firm bought his company, had provided much of the DMT for American human studies. However, his Chicago firm did not give those researchers any manufacturing or animal toxicity data. Lou laughed on the phone as he said, "We just told them it was pure. 95%, more or less. Things were a lot looser then." I wrote to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA, asking if they had some human-grade DMT. When a month elapsed, I wrote again. Mr. W. replied and said NIDA drugs usually came from a laboratory in North Carolina. Dr. C. directed this group. I called Dr. C., who told me they could not make human-grade drugs. When reminded of a recently published study in which his laboratory did so for another research project, he said he'd look into it. Even if he did agree to make the drug, he wouldn't put the drug master file together for the FDA. He said, I don't want the liability. I don't have insurance for human use. It's not in my contract. Dr. C recommended getting some DMT from NIDA and purifying it to the required 99.5% purity. He thought they might have 5 grams or so on the shelf. When asked about this, Mr. W. answered, "Our DMT is too old, and we don't have any manufacturing data." He continued, "We've got a contract with Dr. C. They make what we ask them. There's another laboratory that prepares their drugs for human use. I think the bigger issue is that there is not a lot of movement on DMT these days. It wouldn't be very cost-effective for us to use much money from our contract for such an obscure drug. Let me see what I can find out." A few weeks later, Mr. W. called back, saying Dr. C. could make DMT, but I would have to pay for it. Dr. C. agreed to calculate an estimate, but repeated that he would not put together the required drug file for FDA. It's too much work. This seemed minimally promising. When I asked Ms. R. at the FDA about putting together my own drug file on Dr. C.'s DMT, she said she'd get back to me. If Dr. C. made the DMT, could I really use it? "I'll check with the drug abuse staff here," she answered. "Why wouldn't I be able to?" She answered, "I don't know. Maybe our director, Dr. H., will call you." Dr. C.'s estimate of the cost was over $50,000. "Well," I said, "thanks for looking into it." Another door closed. I called Ms. R. "I'm not having much luck. What do you suggest?" "I'll go to the Federal Archives building and see if I can find the previous DMT researchers' files." In July 1989, Ms. R. found the files for these old studies. "The data in them are terrible," she said. "There's nothing. No animal data, no chemistry data. We closed it. They never responded to our requests for progress reports. It won't help you." "How did you ever approve that study?" "I don't know. I didn't work here then." She tried sounding hopeful. "I'll send the information you need to set up your own drug file." The information she sent was designed for a large drug company such as Lilly, Merck, or Pfizer. It had nothing to do with an individual investigator. I called Ms. R. "I need help. Why aren't you helping me?" "Our director's name is Dr. H. Here's his phone number. Insist on speaking with him." I called Dr. H.'s office. Dr. H.'s secretary said, "You'll need to speak to Dr. W." Before I could protest, he transferred the call to Dr. W. "This is Dr. W," boomed the friendly but commanding voice on the other end of the line. "I'm the only physician on the drug abuse staff in this new division. I know what you've been going through. We're here to help. Don't despair." "How can I get human-grade DMT?" I asked. "Find someone to make it for you." "How about Dave Nichols at Purdue?" He replied, "That's possible." "Could you and Dave talk with each other?" "Have Dr. Nichols write to the director, Dr. H. Here's his address. The name of the staff working on your request is Ms. M. Call her in 2 weeks." I felt something shift with that phone conversation. I called Dave Nichols. He quoted me a price of $300, just the cost of supplies. While all these calls were taking place, I knew that funding from outside the university was crucial for the project to gain all the legitimacy it needed. Additional financial support also would free up my time to find human-grade DMT and help the research center pay for some of the work I requested. This, in turn, would increase the research center's backing of the protocol. In looking over some of the old DMT and schizophrenia research, it appeared that the Scottish Rite Foundation, a branch of the Freemasons, had funded some of it through their schizophrenia research program. I asked this program to send an application for funding. My DMT proposal already discussed the importance of understanding DMT's effects in its possible role as an endogenous schizotoxin. Therefore, it took little work to modify the grant to emphasize these issues more clearly. I wrote Dr. Friedman, telling him of my grant submission to the Scottish Rite Foundation. He replied that he was on their scientific review committee, and maybe they would fund a year's support. Within a month, in September 1989, a notification of award arrived announcing a one-year grant for the project. I again wrote Dr. Friedman, updating him on the search for human-grade DMT. He scribbled a note on my letter and sent a copy of it to the director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse, one of his former students. His telegraphic missive ended, "Strassman needs someone at NIDA responsive. Any suggestions?" In September, I called Mr. W. at NIDA. He had just returned from a meeting with Dr. C. They were discussing how to get Schedule I drugs to researchers. "We want to help," he said. "Call Ms. B. at the DEA and see if she can tell you how to get approval for Dr. Nichols to make a small batch for you. If the amount is too large, he'll need to be a legally designated manufacturer and will never be able to afford the required security." I called Ms. B. "Can Dave Nichols make some human-grade DMT for my project?" She began, "Well, if Dr. Nichols is going to be a manufacturer, he needs to meet rather stringent security requirements. Is there a DEA office near his university? They could drop over and tell him what he needs to do. Then Dr. Nichols could decide if he's able to meet their recommendations." I heard the edge start creeping into my voice. I was alarmed at how close I felt to losing it. "I've looked everywhere for human-grade DMT. Sigma and another chemical supply house, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, the National Institute of Mental Health, former investigators, Dr. C. in North Carolina. Dave Nichols is willing to make some for me, incredibly cheap. He needs your okay. I've got an outside grant and the research center at the university is behind this project. I'm losing my mind. I'm pulling out my hair. My gums are bleeding. I'm getting on my wife's nerves." There was a pause. I heard what sounded like her pushing her chair away from the desk. "Oh," she said, sounding genuinely concerned, "let me see here. Yes, there's a coincidental activities clause in the regulations. Dr. Nichols can make a small batch if you're collaborating. This won't require any additional security for his laboratory." I heard her pull a large book out from somewhere. "It's acceptable for him to make it," and she started reading some text, "if and to the extent set forth." She spoke too quickly for me to write down the information. Ms. B. finished, "Have Dr. Nichols write me. Here's my address. He'll need to amend his current permits, saying how much DMT he'll make. I'll check with our pharmacist to be certain it's a reasonable amount." "Okay," I said. "That sounds great. I really appreciate your help." I called Dr. W. He confided that, off the record, my project was pointing out a flaw in the drug laws. How do researchers study drugs of abuse? He then described exactly how to respond to the 20 requirements the FDA had written about in the 4-page letter that had arrived from them several months earlier. These steps would provide the FDA the information they needed to determine if the DMT was safe for human use. The UNM Department of Psychiatry agreed to pay Dave Nichols $300 for the DMT. However, they would not write the check until the DEA issued the Schedule I permit. The DEA would approve neither Dave's request to make DMT nor my Schedule I permit to possess it until the FDA approved the protocol. The FDA couldn't give me permission until I possessed the drug and tested it for safety. The DEA also required verification from the FDA that Dave could go ahead and make the drug. 4 months later, in January 1990, Dave finally received DEA approval to make the DMT. He ordered the precursors immediately and began working on it. In the meantime, I had gotten laboratory-quality DMT from Sigma and put it into the special locked freezer in the narcotics vault in the hospital pharmacy. 100 milligrams, a tenth of a gram, in a little vial. The research center began developing a method to measure DMT in human blood. In addition, I received a high score from NIDA for a grant application to actually run the DMT study, and it was likely to be funded. 2 grants approved, but no drug. It was bizarre. Everyone wanted the study done, but no one knew how to get me the drug necessary to perform it. By February, the DEA had obtained enough information from the FDA to know that the protocol was sound enough for the FDA to approve in principle. The DEA agreed to give me the Schedule 1 permit. However, my contact there, Ms. L, called with some bad news. Diversion control blocked the permit. "Who's diversion control?" I asked. "I'll try and get your request exempted. I'll call you next week." The next day, Ms. B from the DEA, the woman who had broken the logjam, called to say that Dave was indeed a manufacturer and would need additional security requirements. I didn't know what to say. I told her, "I don't know what to say. Here's the name and phone number of the DEA agent in Indianapolis near Purdue University. He's responsible for that area. He'll tell Dr. Nichols what he needs to do." She called back that day. "I'm sorry. Dr. Nichols is making another drug, and we mixed up that one with your DMT request. My error. You may go ahead as you were planning." Dave called later that week, saying the lawyers at Purdue were advising him not to make the DMT because of liability issues. I called Mr. W. at NIDA and asked him if there were ever any malpractice claims resulting from studies using their Schedule 1 drugs. He offered some encouraging news. "We've never been sued for providing marijuana, a Schedule 1 drug, for human research. Just make sure you've got an airtight informed consent document." He called back that day and put the NIDA attorney on the phone. The attorney said, "You'd be sued first, then your university, then maybe the FDA, and last and most remotely, Dr. Nichols. All he's doing is making it according to FDA regulations. He's not deciding who gives what dose to whom. That's your responsibility." I told Dave this, and he replied, "I hope you know what you're doing. This is a real leap of faith for me and our lawyers." May and June involved finding laboratories to run the FDA-required tests on the DMT once it arrived. One test required the DMT to be sent out, and the first 2 laboratories I contacted refused to work with a Schedule 1 drug. Finally, a 3rd company agreed to do the testing. By July 1990, Dave had made the drug and was running all the tests on it that the FDA needed to determine its identity and purity. It was nearly 100% pure. In early July, he sent 5 grams of DMT to my clinic by overnight courier. I kept it in my office that day and drove to the hospital pharmacy to deliver it before going home. I called Dr. W. to tell him that the DMT had arrived and that it might take a few months to get all the tests performed and collect the results. He said, "Get everything together and send it to Ms. R., the chemist, and Ms. P. Call them a week later. They'll say they never saw your letter. Then call me in 2 weeks if you don't hear anything after that. Some poor guy got his approval and waited a month before we found someone to type the letter to him." The pharmacy prepared a solution of DMT dissolved in salt water. This was the form in which I would give DMT to the volunteers. The pharmacist divided it into 100 separate glass vials. The samples for the FDA's tests would come from them. I had a few last-minute questions and called Ms. R. in September. We hadn't talked for a few months. "I need to refresh my memory about your case," she said. After a few additional phone calls, she provided the necessary information. By late October, all the tests were complete, and the DMT passed every one. I put together my package and sent it to the FDA by overnight mail. I started calling within a week. No one replied to the dozen messages I left with the secretary. I phoned Dr. W. "What's the matter?" he asked. "You usually call when things aren't going well. May I begin the DMT study?" "I'll just tootle on over there and find out what I can." I called back in early November. The secretary told me their division had changed offices, but that they came by every half hour to check for messages. On November 5, 1990, Ms. M., my project officer, called at the end of the day. "Your hold has been removed. Is a verbal okay all I need?" "Yes." "The university won't accept that. Would you fax a letter?" I asked. "I'll fax one tomorrow." November in the mountains of New Mexico is cold and dry, windy and harsh. I made many of these phone calls from my house in the Manzano Mountains southeast of Albuquerque. I sometimes joked to friends that my applications had to be approved because my view was nicer than anyone's in D.C. My former wife's weaving studio was in a separate building about 15 yards from the main house. Hanging up the phone after that last conversation with Ms. M., I braced myself against the cold wind and slowly walked along the crunchy gravel path to the outbuilding to share the news. "They said I could start." I lay down on the cold cement floor, staring up at the ceiling. "That's great, dear," she replied, leaning down to ground level to kiss my cheek. I called every day for the next 10 days, asking for the facts. It arrived on November 15th. At the bottom of the handwritten fax, Ms. M. wrote, "Have a happy Thanksgiving." That day, the university laboratory called to tell me the DMT in the glass vials had decomposed by 30%. It was too weak to use. I called the laboratory technician. "How did you calculate the concentration?" He answered, "By using the weight of free-base DMT." "It's not free-base. It's a salt." "Oh, I didn't know that." "Let's see." "That's right. It's the correct concentration after all. Sorry about that." 4 days later, I gave Philip the first dose of DMT.